So welcome back. We're going to talk about EGFR mutated non-small cell lung cancer. This afternoon, we'll talk about a bunch of other mutations in non-small cell lung cancer, and that's the way it is nowadays in non-small cell lung cancer. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Jonathan Goldman from UCLA Health in Santa Monica, California, and Dr. Zofia Piotrowska from the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. We also have Regina Flores, Dr. Rich Flores from the AdventHealth Orlando here in Orlando from the Florida Cancer Specialist. So we're going to move on and start talking about the metastatic EGFR mutated disease. Jonathan, I never imagined when we first started out with gefitinib, actually. And then there was erlotinib. Remember T790 and all that? And we're way beyond that now. And now we have three options in the metastatic setting. So let's talk about it.
Yeah, it really is a whole new world. Things have changed very quickly. It's my pleasure to speak to you about current management of metastatic EGFR mutation-positive non-small cell lung cancer. Thank you to Dr. Love and the organizers for putting this fabulous event together and inviting me. We have firmly moved into an era beyond sequential monotherapy. We're now in a combination therapy era where the decision is, in general, many patients are going to get intensified therapy and to be careful about those for whom OC monotherapy may be more appropriate. Here are my disclosures. So what's new for metastatic EGFR mutated non-small cell lung cancer? In brief, basically everything. We have new first-line options, FLAURA2 and MARIPOSA. I'm going to touch briefly on subcutaneous amivantamab, talk about continued TKI on progression, and later options, later-line options, MARIPOSA-2 and datopotamab deruxtecan, the ADC. So FLAURA2, this is a trial of OC and chemo versus OC alone as first-line therapy. The addition of platinum and pemetrexed clearly improved all of our important endpoints: objective response rate, duration of response from 15 to 24 months, and median PFS of almost nine months there. Hazard ratio of 0.62. We'll get to overall survival in a minute. But I think these landmark endpoints are really important for patients and discussions with patients. At 12, 18, and 24 months, 15% to 20% more patients are alive and progression-free with the addition of chemotherapy. This was consistent across the two canonical mutations, with or without brain metastases. I think the CNS activity is really heartening. About almost half of patients on the chemo combination had a complete response in the brain. Overall survival, when it was reported last year, really cemented this as an important option for me. These are meaningful differences, about 10 months, 10 to 12 months improvement, hazard ratio 0.77, again, consistent across the subgroups. Most patients did get second-line therapy, increasing our confidence in this. Toxicity is important, but I'd say it's toxicity we're all very comfortable managing, primarily the addition of hematologic toxicity. MARIPOSA-2 is another first-line option. This looked at amivantamab and lazertinib versus osimertinib with a small arm of lazertinib to address what we call contribution of components. I'm going to talk about amivantamab, a really interesting drug. This is a bispecific to EGFR and MET. It not only blocks the ligand, but it also causes ligand internalization and degradation and possibly directs an immune-mediated attack on the cancer cell. The progression-free survival benefit is significant and clinically meaningful. This was both EGFR exon 19 and L858R, and again, with and without brain metastases. So in some ways, very similar data. Toxicity, though, highly different. A whole new set of toxicities. Infusion-related reactions are important. We'll talk about subcutaneous AMI in a second, but also some peripheral edema as well as dermatologic toxicities, which I think will take a lot of our patients' attention. Unexpectedly, clotting and thromboembolic events was seen, leading to introduction of some mitigating strategies, 4 months of anticoagulation. The SKIPPER and COCOON trial introduced dexamethasone in a pretty extensive dermatologic regimen, which is quite helpful, but does take a lot of patient time and family time. So comparing these two very good, interesting options is challenging. They both have good survival benefit that is similar. Hazard ratio is very close, 0.75 and 0.77, consistent across the subgroups. There are perhaps some small differences in co-mutation selection, but I think a lot of the differences come down to toxicity, patient preferences, time in the office, and some aversion to chemotherapy. But the difference between chemotoxicity and dermatologic toxicity is where it comes down to for most patients. Subcutaneous amivantamab is still being rolled out in many offices. It improves administration time, patient convenience, and significantly reduces infusion reactions. Interestingly, as reported last year, the Paloma 3 trial did show an overall survival benefit with this sub-Q formulation. I think this is interesting, and we'll see what impact that shows in future studies. We'll now take a step back to osimertinib monotherapy, and what do we know about the resistance mechanisms to OSI? This is data from the ORCHARD trial both Zosia and I participated in, biomarker-based trial looking at 400 tissue samples, 191 plasma samples. Most patients, 87%, had identifiable resistance alterations, but challengingly, more almost half had multiple ones. I'll touch on some of the most important ones. MET amplification in 18%, which may end up being a therapeutic direction, leading to a therapeutic direction. Secondary EGFR mutations, also interesting, C797 being the best characterized, and again, may have some therapeutic implications. EGFR amplification does not have therapeutic implications. And we have these interesting BRAF fusions, HER2 mutations, RAS mutations, and fusions. And lastly, I think the most important reason to rebiopsy these patients, histologic transformation to squamous cell or small cell, which specifically does lead to chemotherapy directions.
So maybe before you go on, we ought to take a breath and talk a little bit about first-line therapy in this situation. One of the more challenging, I think, situations in oncology. Zosia, I'm curious, in a typical month, how many people do you sit down with who you're going to sit down with for first discussion of first-line therapy of EGFR mutant disease?
You know, several. I mean, I think you really notice it more because now it's so complicated and takes so much time. I would say, you know, probably at least 2 to 3 times a month we're having this conversation.
And then I'm curious, you know, different sort of, I'm not going to say patient types, but people have different, you know, comorbidities, different attitudes, all the way from maybe a patient in very good condition, very pro-treatment, not worried about toxicity, to a patient with comorbidities, maybe older, who's very, very concerned about toxicities. How do you think through in your own mind, you know, what you're going to recommend to the patient, and how do you discuss it with them?
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's really important to sort of be introspective about what we're going to recommend, because we can talk about sort of, you know, helping patients make that choice, but ultimately how we come into that conversation and how we present the data, I think, has a huge part in how patients choose. You know, they're really coming to us for advice on what to choose. I think, as Jonathan alluded to, we sort of started from a paradigm of who should we escalate in, and now I think we're really thinking more about, are there patients where we might de-escalate and still think about OC monotherapy? In those patients, you know, it really is the older patients, more frail, maybe renal impairment, and those who really strongly, you know, want to avoid the increased toxicities of a combination regimen. But for most patients, I would say it's a choice between FLAURA2 and MARIPOSA, and it does come down to the sort of toxicity profile. To be honest, I think a lot of us have a lot of comfort with platinum pemetrexed and osimertinib. It's a regimen we've used in later line settings, so that's more commonly my sort of selection. But there are some patients for whom the idea of chemotherapy is a challenge. There are some for whom renal function, you know, the creatinine clearance cutoff for pemetrexed can be a challenge. And I think now, especially with subcutaneous amivantamab, I think, you know, there still are patients for whom MARIPOSA is also an option.
When the patient asks you in terms of what's going to give me the best result in terms of the cancer, MARIPOSA versus FLAURA2, what do you say?
I would say I don't think we have a clear answer to that yet. It does come down to what we're going to talk about next also, you know, what our subsequent sort of options are going to be from each of these regimens. But if you look at these data sets, they really are, I think, quite similar actually across the board in terms of the efficacy at least.
So I'm going to be curious to see what Regina has to say in terms of her own practice. But Jonathan, you know, it's kind of ironic. I was kind of reminiscing back to at one point there was a trial, I think it was called the IPASS study, that actually compared chemo to, I think, is it erlotinib? I'm not sure.
Gefitinib.
Gefitinib, okay. And it showed that actually the people did better with gefitinib. Everybody's all excited. We don't need to use chemo. Now here we are, whatever, 10, 15 years later, we're using both. Again, how do you present this to a patient? And when, you know, you might have a medical oncologist as a patient who can understand all the data. How do you shade it for them?
Yeah, I mean, it really is back to the future. In some disappointing ways, I guess, you know, we really got to a low toxicity regimen, and now we're talking about introducing meaningful toxicity, and that does change the experience for patients coming to the office so much and having to think about their cancer. But, you know, approximately a year longer survival is very meaningful. So many of these patients are young. So that's a very frequent question, exactly what you're saying. And I do say the data looks really similar. I think that the experience between cycles, though, is probably a little bit easier with the chemotherapy combination than the AMI combination. The derm toxicity is challenging. The nails, you know, bleeding nails and scalp can be difficult.
And Zosia, how often do you have the patients have brain mets at the time of diagnosis, and how does that affect, if at all, your discussion?
I would say quite a lot, you know, and both of these studies, actually, the number was about similar, about 40% of patients. And I think that's reflective of my practice. It feels like probably close to half of my patients. So it does come into it. Actually, I just had a patient in clinic last week who has a lot of brain mets, I think more than 30 brain mets. And we were rushing to start the osimertinib first because we know that that's very CNS penetrant. But I think now, equally importantly, we're setting him up to start chemotherapy this week because the rate of complete response in the brain was, I think, notable and really impressive in Flora too. So, you know, I think we see that with both regimens. But there, I think the way the data has been presented with Flora too, I really do feel a lot of comfort with that regimen for patients with brain mets.
And this patient, did the patient have neurologic symptoms?
Yeah.
So would have required whole brain radiation if it would?
Exactly. We were actually all teed up for him to start whole brain radiation, waiting for the next generation sequencing results, knowing that we were going to, you know, potentially cancel the radiation, which we were fortunate to be able to do. But yeah, this comes up not infrequently, unfortunately.
Regina, I'm kind of curious how this plays out in your practice. Of course, you've got patients with colon cancer, breast cancer, and everything else as well to think about. I don't know how often you encounter this situation, but how do you find patients responding or people saying, why can't I just take osimertinib?
Well, I think patients always like to take pills. But I think osimertinib is easy. I know, but when you come to some of the other drugs that we use for lung cancer, like the dapatinib, I have very challenging times using that drug. But, you know, having said all of this, I'd like to introduce a case, you know, which I've been following for 10 years now. And 54-year-old lady presented with 30-pound weight loss in 2016. So she presented exon 21, T790 mutation, M mutation up front. So at that time, I treated her with osimertinib. She, 10 years later, she is alive, very good quality of life. She's going to be a Medicare patient soon. Her copay was $7,000 a month for the osimertinib, but we were able to help her with that. Now, I told her before you would sign up for this free gym membership in Medicare, you better tell them that you're on this drug. So fast forward, you know, this lady will present now, and I have this data. How can I tease those patients out, you know? The other thing is I've been thinking about all these years. I've been treating Asian non-smokers. They live for a long time with just single agent or, just osimertinib. Do you have those patients in your patient population, and did you tease them out, you know, in that data?
So, Zosia, before you answer, I'm curious. So this lady's still on osimertinib?
Yeah.
And any toxicity at all?
Hardly any. I mean, the lady had MS at presentation. She had a foot drop. She's even off her MS medication. The foot drop is hardly noticeable. I wonder, is this a paraneoplastic syndrome? But she's very good quality of life. I mean, she was getting tired of me scanning her. So at some point, you know, maybe at the fourth year, she was telling me, I pay so much for those CAT scans. Can I just have them every 6 months? Well, sure. You know, you don't have any symptoms, no pain, no cough. We'll just do them every 6 months at the bone scan. That's all I do for her.
I'm not going to say cell-free DNA, but anyhow. So, Zosia, how often do you see something like this, first of all? And then, as Regina says, how can you pick these people out?
So these are the cases that haunt us. And I think these are the cases that, you know, we still all wonder about. And no, yes, you know, if we knew that patient, if we saw that patient today and we knew that that was the response she was going to have to OC, of course we'd want to avoid all the extra toxicities of these side effects. But the question is, how do we identify them? And the short answer is, I don't think we quite know yet. You know, each of these studies has done a careful look at different high-risk subgroups, looking at whether, you know, brain metastases, liver metastases, P53 co-mutations, all these different things. And in each case, of course, the combination is better than the monotherapy. And so it's hard to know how to, you know, every patient fits into at least one category, at least in most of my patients. What I would say, the one data set sort of going back to the ctDNA that has caught my eye is in FLAURA2, when you looked at patients who did not have detectable ctDNA at baseline, that usually correlates to a pretty low disease burden. And in those patients, there was less of a benefit to adding chemotherapy. So I think if you have a patient who has very low burden of disease, you know, maybe only pleural disease, negative ctDNA, I think that, you know, it's a conversation. The challenge is you don't know if that patient's going to be in that 10-year category, if they're going to progress in 18 months. And so if they're young and healthy, I think it still feels hard to counsel them, you know, you don't have to do chemotherapy. You wonder, but, you know, this is an area of research. I think we need better biomarkers to try to discern this more effectively.
So also just get back to the brain mets question, you know, and this whole strategy that really started with EGFR, and now you see it in all different kind of places, both in lung cancer and out, of holding off on radiation and using systemic therapy, particularly if they're going to need whole brain. What about patients who have localized brain mets, no symptoms, and they can be treated with SRS? Do you treat them with the SRS, or you still use systemic therapy? And also, do you see more intracranial benefit by adding in chemo?
I think the answer is yes. It does seem like, you know, when I first saw the FLAURA2 data, I said, well, OC works so well in the brain. What's chemo really going to add? But if you look at the waterfall plots, there's clearly more deep responses, more complete responses. So I think the answer is yes, it does add something. I try to see all of these patients together with a radiation oncologist, you know, and so for most of them, we do hold off on radiation, start the TKI and monitor closely. I would say we usually end up being able to hold off on stereotactic radiosurgery or targeted radiation. Occasionally, we do have patients where a brain met doesn't respond as well and we add it in. But we know that for patients who live many years, you also worry about the long-term risk of radiation necrosis, which can become symptomatic and, you know, can have come with its own problems. So if we can hold off, I think the radiation oncologists are usually happy to, as long as we're monitoring their brain disease closely.
So the other thing that's come out of this algorithm, Jonathan, that we hear about is when we talk about holding off on radiation is patients without neurologic symptoms or signs. But on the other hand, maybe it's okay to have a little bit of neurologic, like how much will get you to say, okay, I'm sorry, even though you got EGFR, we got to radiate you.
You know, everything Zosia said, I would underline. We can get OC started so quickly, and almost all patients feel better within 3 or 4 days. I think that timeline really, you know, is equal to or better than radiation improvement timeline. So I think it's things like midline, you know, old school stuff like midline shift, very significant edema. There are patients that will still go to the operating room if they have a single very, and perhaps have limited disease outside of the brain as well. Then I do think we're still taking an aggressive approach. But most patients are starting targeted therapy, getting a very quick MRI. We get a lot more MRIs than we used to, maybe at 4 or 6 weeks to make sure we're going in a good direction.
So before you continue, I know you had just shown the slide of what you see on progression in terms of these other mutations that come out, MET, et cetera. And I know, Regina, you had questions about like what kind of assays to do in that situation. Anything you want to ask the faculty in terms of working a patient up who's progressing on osimertinib or osimertinib chemo or AMI laser?
Yeah, you know, so when patients progress, you know, it's easy enough to do the liquid biopsy. I'd like to do the rebiopsy of tissue if I can, but sometimes it's hard to convince patients to do that. Sometimes when I do the liquid biopsy, the EGFR mutation is not there. I mean, in the past that happened, so I said, uh-oh, what do I do next? But, you know, the other thing I'd like to ask you is this acquired MET mutation, which you said happens in 18% of patients. And one of the choices would be to add in tepotinib, you know, which I find a very hard drug, 80% edema, you know. And I've played with it, you know, stop it, change the schedule, 1 week on, 1 week off, you know, different things. It's a very hard one. Can you tell us more about it?
We also have amivantamab, which has, you know, met activity.
Absolutely. It's amazing the level of sophistication that you have treating all the different cancers. I think the questions are exactly the things
I agree.
that we face. We do ctDNA. We try to get a biopsy. Again, I think trying to make sure you haven't missed small cell transformation or squamous transformation. We used to feel that you would be able to tell the difference on a scan. An exploding lesion would be more likely small cell, but that's not always true. So I do think it's important to try to do the biopsy, but we do sometimes have to decide without it. And I think all of those points are correct. You know, if I see a MET amplification, I do try to try a MET TKI. I think AMI is also a very reasonable direction. Clinical trials are important. We do have data, or data is still coming out with savolitinib and other MET TKIs. So I think, you know, that is an important subgroup of patients. Right now, I'm usually adding in a MET TKI.
Zosia, what about this idea if they don't have the EGFR mutation? Does that affect how you think? And also, when you do see small cell transformation, do they respond to small cell strategies? Of course, everybody asks about tarlatamab.
So the first question, I think, is a really important point. And I think it specifically relates to liquid biopsies.
Yes.
You know, I think when you don't detect the EGFR mutation in a liquid biopsy, I think what that's telling you is there's not enough DNA shed into the circulation for that test to be informative, which is good information to have, right? Basically, you can say, I didn't get a sample that I can test there. So I think that's a situation where, again, you might think about a tissue biopsy. Tissue biopsies, you tend not to see sort of loss of the driver mutation. Those tend to be sort of canonical mutations that are always present. So I think the liquid biopsy result more likely reflects just the sensitivity of the assay. Small cell transformation, one pearl I just wanted to throw out there that I think about is, you know, particularly patients who have co-mutations in P53 and RB1, those patients are significantly higher risk of histologic transformation, and those I think are particularly important to be really vigilant and think about biopsies for. So if you have patients where on their NGS reports they have EGFR, P53, and RB1, always sort of keep your antenna up for small cell transformation there. For patients who transform, you know, I think they can have benefit from platinum etoposide. You know, we see that they can respond. Unfortunately, as many small cells that tend not to be very durable responses, but they certainly can respond, and that's usually my sort of first go-to. The tarlatamab question is really interesting, and there's data emerging on it. There was just recently a publication from a bunch of places, Dana-Farber, MGH, MSK, that showed that, you know, the likelihood of benefit is probably lower with transformed small cell. That being said, we've still used it off-label, and I have had a couple of patients who have responded, so I think we are still learning. You know, I think we have to be cautious with tarlatamab for these patients.
Yeah, of course, you got prostate also.
Yeah. I just had this really interesting case. We just got the biopsy back. So small cell transformation, did tarlatamab on a clinical trial, had a really nice response, and then progression about 6 months later in the liver. We biopsied it, and it was adenocarcinoma.
Wow.
So, you know, these patients are so complex, patient to patient, but also their tumor is so heterogeneous.
So I'm curious what your thoughts are about this COMPEL trial. I thought it was one of the most interesting trials of the year in terms of EGFR. You know, we've always had this idea, should we keep the OC going in people who progress? This is an incredible study.
Yeah, it's such an important real-world question. This was patients that were progressing on OC monotherapy. A lot of physicians did not feel comfortable with holding OC in patients with CNS progression, so those patients were not enrolled, but still there was a CNS benefit to continuing the OC versus chemo alone. So I think those PFS curves speak for themselves. This is probability of CNS progression, so, you know, really a big part of the benefit is the CNS protection, just like people were saying for many years. Now I'm going to move on to Mariposa 2. So this is another one of the big AMI trials that came out, and we do have to think about what role it plays. This was for patients that were progressing on OC monotherapy, and then were randomized to amivantamab lazertinib with chemotherapy versus chemotherapy versus AMI chemo. So again, basically it is AMI chemo plus or minus lazertinib versus chemo. Both AMI arms did better. The PFS curves are meaningfully different. The hazard ratio of under 0.5, I think, led to a lot of enthusiasm and to FDA approval about a year and a half ago. The forest plot shows consistency of benefit across the subgroups. if we there was some very interesting data looking at patients who had, you know, met causes of resistance or others, and the short is that there was benefit to the combination in all of the groups. And so I think it's an important endpoint that makes us think, but it does not help a lot, I would say, in treatment decision-making. Adverse events, we did talk some about this, but really a significant both benefit by adding amivantamab, but also toxicities. You have the EGFR, paronychia, and rash toxicities, the MET peripheral edema that was mentioned, and then the chemotoxicities. This, in general, has led us to consider ami-chemo, not ami-las-chemo, due to a sense that the additional benefit was not worth the additional toxicity there. We don't have OS final results yet, but the second interim OS update showed some benefit, about 2.5 months almost, with a hazard ratio of 0.7, but by the statistical design was not statistically significant. So that will continue to be followed up. So now I'm going to move on to antibody-drug conjugates. I'm sure you've been speaking a lot about these this weekend. It combines both the specificity of an antibody, bringing in the cytotoxicity of the payload. We're going to focus on datopotamab deruxtecan, a TROP2 ADC with a TOPO1 payload. What happened was that the TROPION-Lung01 trial, which was a trial compared to docetaxel, showed that there was a benefit in the AGA, that's actionable genomic alteration cohort. Most of those were EGFR mutated. And that led to a combined pooled analysis from both that trial and a separate trial called Lung05, which was a single-arm trial. And so in total, you had 117 EGFR mutant patients, and some of them were in a cohort compared to docetaxel. I think the most heartening part about this is really the diversity of patients, this wide variety of EGFR mutations, which very closely matches what we see in clinic. Some answers for what do we do for exon 18 patients, for example, that we didn't know before, and a couple patients with squamous cell disease. So that I'd like to see. You have a 43% response rate, which really got everyone's attention. And I think that the toxicity is, I think, the main concern, which also was just brought up by Dr. Flores. The mucositis is in the significant majority. Ocular surface events, usually mild, though, but something to talk about with patients, in about a third, in a low but important rate of interstitial lung disease and pneumonitis. So coming to the end of my talk, I just wanted to review these first-line options, FLAURA2 and MARIPOSA, and the potential coming importance of subcutaneous amivantamab. We've moved beyond monotherapy for most patients to combination therapies, data for continued TKI and progression, and these later-line options of MARIPOSA2 and datopotamab deruxtecan. We now have many options, but frankly, somewhat limited understanding of how to put them together. So I think we'll probably talk about that in an important issue that faces us, I'd say, every week in clinic. We have clinical trials with upcoming readouts and FDA decisions, which will also help us as we move forward. And that was my last slide, I believe. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, let's dig into this a little bit more. And Zosia, I'm curious about your experience with Dato-DXd. Is this something that you're turning to? And that waterfall plot looks pretty impressive with that. Of course, we've talked about this with breast cancer extensively. Is this something you turn to in this situation? What's your experience with it?
Yeah, I think I agree. You know, it's sort of a strange data set, but overall, I think it's impressive data. We were chatting before coming on stage that, you know, it's certainly, I think, you know, looks superior to some of the other options we have in this setting, like docetaxel and others, just, you know, sort of comparing across trials. The way that I think about this is really, we know that TKIs have benefit. We know amivantamab has benefit. We know that chemo has benefit. But you sort of, no matter what combination you choose, you end up using up those three options in your first two lines of therapy. And so I think Dato gives us a different mechanism of action, a new drug to use in that post-platinum doublet setting, and I think it's really helpful there.
What's your experience with it in terms of toxicity? What do you say to patients ahead of time? I'm curious about Regina's experience too, because again, it's a drug that's commonly used. It's interesting that it's a lung people and ask the breast people about the toxicity. You can look at the numbers from the trial, but it's always helpful to hear the clinical experience? Particularly, I'm curious about mucositis and whether you do anything preemptive with it.
Yeah, so we do steroid mouth rinses beforehand prophylactically. That does seem to help. And then cryotherapy, just having patients suck on ice chips during the infusion, seems to help somewhat. So we do that, and I think it makes a difference. I think it does make it easier for patients. You know, the ocular surface things, that one of the headaches is that they're supposed to have a baseline eye exam, and so sometimes getting that coordinated before they start can be a challenge, but important to sort of keep an eye out for eye things. And then the other one that in discussion with patients, in my experience, EGFR patients ask a lot about is alopecia. About half of patients in the study did have alopecia. And that, frankly, for patients who have been on regimens that haven't led to hair loss until this point, sometimes that can be a tough part of, you know, sort of the treatment decision-making. And for some patients, factors into the decision.
I don't. You know, yesterday, we were also saying, we were just at the SGO meeting, and the gynecologists have this thing. It's like a ice thing that you put in your mouth. It's like a device. You ever seen it or heard of it?
I think that it's probably a kid.
They like it. No, but it's like you put it in your freezer and you know you use it. And Regina, have you ever heard of that?
Yeah, we have that in our office. So we're rolling that out in FCS offices, certain satellite offices. You know, it comes in like an igloo box. You know, so we're rolling it out for basically all agents that could cause mucositis. So Dato is one of them.
The patient just puts it in their mouth. For how long do they keep it in there?
You know, honestly, I've just started using it now. You know, I know that we have it available. Just started talking to the nurses about it. We rolled it out last week. So I don't know yet. I can't really tell you.
Any experience with Dato either in lung cancer, EGFR mutant, or in breast? And
breast.
What have you seen in terms of toxicity?
Because we've used it before in clinical trial, you know, for breast. So I don't think I'll have a hard time using it for lung. You know, the dexamethasone mouth rinses, you know, mouth care. The ocular toxicity, I don't think is a big deal. You know, I haven't really found that as a big deal for the patients. So I don't think it's going to be a hard drug.
Yeah, we had, as mentioned, we did a whole program on ocular toxicity, and Dato was pretty low down. I'm not even sure you need to. I guess you need to get an ophthalmic exam initially. Another thing I want to bring up and ask you about, Jonathan, I think there was a paper looking at consolidation radiation therapy in these patients that we didn't talk about, but I think it's pretty cool. When you give the osimertinib or osimertinib chemo, whatever, you get your response and then radiate residual disease. Is that the strategy you're using?
So I think it's really an area of a lot of discussion. We have now several smaller trials, and so... You know, in general, I've been hesitant to change my practice based on small trials of this size. A lot of very interesting research from MD Anderson, primarily. When I think about consolidation radiation, a lot of times I like to go to a PET scan. There, it's not so much data driven, just sort of common sense that if there's a hot area, limited area that's positive on FDG, then radiating that makes some sense to me. However, we have a lot of patients that don't. That's the most common, is that patients have a really good response at 3 to 4 months. And I'm not sure we're so good at knowing a year later where are they going to progress. But the data is really intriguing, and it keeps coming. So the practice may change.
I think it was a randomized study, actually. So yeah. Anyhow. All right, let's move on now. On Zosha, we're going to talk about exon 20 and also localized EGFR disease.
Yes, so we have sort of a grab bag of topics. We'll start with exon 20 insertions and the agents in development there. We'll spend a few minutes on sort of novel agents for the classic mutations and then wrap up with non-metastatic disease. So these are my disclosures. So starting off with exon 20 insertions. So the first point is just to keep in mind that these are different than the classical mutation. So exon 20 insertions are about 10% of all EGFR mutations in lung cancer. They're really a diverse group of insertion mutations spanning exon 20, as you can see here. And the main thing to keep in mind is that NGS reports, I think, are getting increasingly good at actually specifying is the protein that the structure that they're sort of giving you, is that an exon 20 insertion? If the NGS report is not clear, it's worth reaching out to the pathologist who issued it just to clarify with them, because it's important to identify exon 20 insertions as different, because as we'll see, these really go down a different treatment paradigm than our classical EGFR mutations. So for a patient with an exon 20 insertion in EGFR, currently amivantamab and chemotherapy is our first-line standard of care. So we're not starting yet with a TKI. We're actually starting with chemo with amivantamab. And that came about because of the Papillon trial. This was a first-line study for exon 20 insertion positive patients where amivantamab was combined with chemotherapy and compared to chemotherapy alone. And there was a significant improvement in progression-free survival, about 11.4 months with ami chemo here, as well as a higher response rate, about 73% with the combination. The OS data is still immature, but also trended in the right direction. And this really led to the approval of this and the adoption in the NCCN guidelines. I think, nevertheless, you know, you see that at EGFR on the NGS report, you get excited, and then you read exon 20. It's disappointing not to have a first-line TKI option for these patients, or at least a regimen that includes a TKI. And I think the hope is that this will change in the near future. We just saw a press release, and we'll see data from this study at ASCO, of a first-line study comparing an exon 20-specific TKI called sunvozertinib, which we'll talk about more in detail in a moment, compared to chemotherapy. This was the Wukong 28 study. So first-line EGFR exon 20 insertions, sunvozertinib versus chemo, and the press release is that the primary endpoint of PFS was positive. So stay tuned. That'll be presented in the orals at ASCO. But what do we know about sunvozertinib so far? So this actually does have accelerated approval in the United States, but unfortunately it hasn't been available due to sort of manufacturing and distribution issues. It's made by a Chinese company, and there hasn't been a way for it to be sort of manufactured and distributed in the U.S. even since its approval in July of last year. But the approval came from this Wukong 1B study, which was a study in the EGFR exon 20 insertion positive patient population after chemotherapy. The approved dose in the U.S. is 200 milligrams daily, and you can see that the confirmed response rate was about 46%, median PFS of about 8.4 months. There was a small cohort of patients who had prior amivantamab in this study, and you know, we sort of that's the relevant population in a second-line study now that we're giving chemo amivantamab first-line. The response rate seemed to be a little bit lower there, 25%, but keep in mind that's very small numbers of patients. What about safety? This has been a challenge in this space. Some of the older TKIs first approved for exon 20 insertion struggled a lot with EGFR-related toxicities, drugs like mobocertinib that actually ended up coming off the market largely for that reason. Sunvozertinib does seem to be better tolerated. The rate of diarrhea is about 70%, but most of these are grade 1. We also can see some CPK increase and rash, but again, most of these are grade 1 and 2 toxicities. So stay tuned for more on sunvozertinib. My hope is it will become available for our patients. It's really hard to, you know, tell patients there's this drug approved but not available. I'm sure some of you have also had that conversation. So maybe after ASCO things will change, but it remains to be seen. Another drug to keep an eye on in this space is zipalertinib. This is another exon 20 specific TKI developed in the initially in the post-chemotherapy setting where we saw a response rate of about 40%. Again, looking at patients who had prior amivantamab, we saw that the response rate was about 30%, so a little bit lower, but still respectable here. Interestingly, last fall we saw data from a small cohort of patients with measurable brain metastases who got zipalertinib, and this is really important because I would say intracranial efficacy has been a big challenge in the development of drugs for exon 20 insertions. We don't have very many CNS penetrant therapies here, and these data are small but encouraging. These are intracranial response rates, and you can see that, you know, many of these patients are having shrinkage of tumors in the brain. The official response rate was about similar in the 30% range, about similar to the systemic therapy response rate, again suggesting that this drug is getting into the brain, which is great. And then toxicity-wise with zipalertinib, it's mostly dermatologic toxicities, paronychia, rash, dermatitis. But again, mostly these are low grade. There's not a lot of grade 3 or greater toxicity. So these tend to be manageable, and the rate of diarrhea was only around 20%. So all of these studies have frontline studies ongoing. As you can imagine, all of these TKIs want to be positioned as first-line therapy. The zipalertinib trial took more of an approach similar to FLAURA2, where it's actually combining with chemotherapy. The sunvozertinib is the one that we'll hear the results of in a few weeks at ASCO, but the press release says that one is positive. I didn't have time to talk about furmonertinib, but it's another exon 20 TKI that's being developed here. So my hope is in the future, you know, the landscape here will change, and we will have a TKI or a TKI-based option for these patients in the not too distant future, maybe even after Wukong 28.
So a couple questions. Jonathan, what's your current first line approach to metastatic exon 20, and what do you think it's going to be in the next year or two?
So chemo amivantamab, I think, is clearly a choice that ami by itself with chemo, I think, is often tolerated for patients, you know, versus the addition of a TKI with ami, so that we were talking about before. So a lot of the derm toxicities are not too bad with the first-line ami chemo, I would say. I think sunvocertinib is a complicated distribution question that has been disappointing, but not clear to me that that's going to be resolved, actually. So zipalertinib maybe is more positioned to actually be clinically available. Not yet, but hopefully, I would say within a year seems like a very reasonable goal for our patients.
So, Zosia, a question from the audience. I'm talking about people being well-informed. I completely forgot about it. It's really interesting. Dato in the rare EGFR mutations. It works, right?
So as Jonathan sort of showed on that pie chart of all the different resistance or the different types of EGFR mutations included in that analysis were exon 20 patients and the rare mutations. And so the approval for Dato is for all EGFR mutations. And, you know, they're really small numbers to say sort of does it work equally well in the atypicals versus classical. But I do try it for patients with both atypical and exon 20 insertions.
Another practical question from the audience: with FLAURA2 really being used so much, what's your second line therapy after FLAURA2?
So I think it depends a little bit on how the FLAURA2 was given. You know, many of these patients will be on chemo for a period of time and then will stop the chemo and stay on TKI. If it's been a while since they've stopped the chemotherapy, more than 6 or even better 12 months, sometimes they'll go to chemotherapy amivantamab in that setting and rechallenge. You know, I think it's challenging to sort of reuse the same chemo, but we don't have a lot of other good options. The other option is, of course, a clinical trial if we have it, or Dato-DXd, I think, is you know, the other kind of obvious choice. I think Amilaser has activity in that post-chemo setting, but it's not approved. So sometimes we also try for that in the later line setting if we can get it off-label.
All right, let's keep going here.
All right, so other novel agents. What else are we excited about for the classical EGFR mutations? And so I wanted to touch on ivonescimab. This is actually data that Jonathan is very familiar with and presented at the plenary session at World Lung last year. So ivonescimab is a compound which you can see the sort of design of in the figure here. So this is an antibody with an arm against PD-1, just like a regular checkpoint inhibitor, and also an arm against VEGF. So this is a PD-1 VEGF bispecific antibody. And it's really being developed in EGFR, in part because we know the VEGF pathway can be important for these cancers and that PD-1 on its own has been ineffective for these tumors. And the HARMONY trial looked at ivonescimab with chemotherapy versus chemotherapy with placebo in EGFR mutant cancers progressing on third generation TKIs. The co-primary endpoints of HARMONY were PFS and overall survival. And as you can see here, the PFS was improved by about 2 months, 4.4 to 6.8 months. Hazard ratio was 0.52. If we look at overall survival, it gets a little bit more complicated. Sort of for context, this study actually initially was designed and started first in China. But based on the encouraging data that was seen, it was then expanded and later enrolled patients in North America and in Europe. But those patients were enrolled later and therefore had shorter follow-up on the study. You can see the follow-up times here. When you look at the overall population, this is the co-primary endpoint of the study, it was numerically better in terms of overall survival for ivonescimab and chemotherapy, 16.8 versus 14 months. But the hazard ratio, 0.79, didn't quite meet statistical significance, just missing that p-value, as you can see there. Jonathan presented, and we can certainly talk about this, an interesting sort of follow-up with more follow-up time for those North American and European patients, and it did cross into that statistically significant range, but this was a co-primary endpoint of the study, and technically it was negative. So this is currently under FDA review, and we'll have to see what they sort of decide about this study. But if we take a little bit more of a dive, we can see that the response rate was a little bit higher with IVO chemotherapy versus chemotherapy alone. The median duration of response was actually nearly doubled with IVO chemotherapy here as well. And then if we look at safety, you know, overall there was no surprises here. The most common toxicities were hematologic toxicities related to chemotherapy. The rates of discontinuation of ivonescimab were low across both arms. But when we look specifically at the two arms of that bispecific antibody, the VEGF and the PD-1, you can see, of course, increased immune-related adverse events and VEGF-related adverse events when patients are treated with ivonescimab. But none of these, I would say, were sort of really concerning. None of these raised alarm bells. Most of these were low-grade toxicities. We do see proteinuria, hypertension, hemorrhage. We have to dig back to our bevacizumab days and monitoring these patients, but there were no sort of concerning signals in terms of high-grade toxicities.
So, Jonathan, let's talk a little bit about IVO. I know there's a big paper going to be presented at ASCO on the drug. Curious what your experience is, what your thoughts are about where it's heading, what kind of tolerability issue. I never thought about autoimmune toxicity, but it's PD-1, so I guess you do see that. Well, what do we know about it at this point?
So, actually, expertly presented. It's an interesting area. I think we're going to. I don't know what to expect from the FDA. I do think the toxicities are interestingly similar to other single targeted agents, but perhaps a little bit less. The half-life is actually shortened, so maybe that reduces a little bit of the bleeding risks of bevacizumab, for example. And the autoimmune toxicities were mostly thyroid, so for significant majority of patients, not very meaningful or very manageable. It was a trial where I couldn't tell which arm the patients were on.
Wow.
We had some patients that were unblinded for one reason or another, and they were on active drug, and I didn't know it. So I think that's a strong argument for it, that there is a clear PFS benefit without a lot of added toxicity. But we'll have to see what the FDA says about this OS endpoint, which was so close, but on the wrong side.
And what do we know about what, do you think you see the same thing with PD-1 and Bev?
So, it does bring us back to Empower 150, which was, Bev-Atezo with chemotherapy. And I think that, I do still sometimes use that regimen, but not very often. I do think that it does have a role in EGFR patients. But this was perhaps a cleaner study, you would say, from the front, focus on EGFR patients. And I think there are some real questions that were brought up in the discussion. How much of the benefit here is VEGF? How much is PD-1? And at this point, I would say it's a hard question to answer. There were patients with really prolonged benefit, and that could have been consistent with an immunotherapy benefit, but really just hard to know. I think that there is data coming out, as you said, that will be presented at ASCO in a non-EGFR cohort. And I think that will also be instructive. I think it very likely will be a drug that we'll be using in one form or another.
Yeah, it's a plenary presentation at ASCO, so it's going to be really interesting to see that. Okay, Zosia, let's keep going.
All right. So this is just to summarize, that we have all these different options. And again, just to very briefly say, we do have other emerging agents to keep an eye on. Sacituzumab tirumotecan is a novel TROP2 ADC that beat both docetaxel and platinum doublet chemotherapy and overall survival in Chinese studies. And there are now U.S. studies ongoing. So that's one to sort of keep an eye on in future talks about EGFR. But in the last minute or two, let's just move on to non-metastatic EGFR-positive disease. Now, old news about the role of adjuvant osimertinib. Of course, the ADAURA trial demonstrated that adjuvant osimertinib improves both disease-free and overall survival in resected EGFR mutant lung cancer. But this year we saw NEO-ADAURA, which tries to bring osimertinib into the preoperative space. And so in NEO-ADAURA, these were patients with resectable stage 2 to 3 non-small cell lung cancers with classical EGFR mutations. They were randomized to 3 neoadjuvant regimens. So prior to surgery, either chemo plus OC for 3 cycles, OC alone for 9 weeks, or chemotherapy plus placebo. The primary endpoint of the study was major pathologic response, and that was improved. You can see it was about 25% in both of the OC-containing arms. The rates of PathCR, I think, were disappointing in this study, only 4 and 9% in these two arms, but clearly both are better than chemotherapy alone. The event-free survival data was quite immature. This was really an early readout, so we don't have good data yet, but in this early readout, it seems like maybe favoring OC chemotherapy. So this isn't yet approved, but something to keep in mind for patients where you're sort of worried about taking them to surgery. And then now 2 years ago, we saw the results of the LAURA study. So sort of now taking it to the unresectable stage 3 patients treated with chemotherapy and radiation, if they have no progression, the LAURA trial showed that osimertinib consolidation, sort of akin to the PACIFIC trial, but here using osimertinib, does significantly improve progression-free survival. You can see a huge separation in those curves, and that is an approved regimen now. So putting all of that together, I think if you have a patient with a resectable lung cancer with a classical mutation, it's really a discussion with the surgeon of whether that patient should go to surgery first and then get adjuvant chemotherapy and osimertinib, chemotherapy if indicated, and osimertinib on the back end. If patients have unresectable stage 3 disease and they get chemo RT, they should definitely get osimertinib after the chemo RT. It's the borderline resectable cases where we have the most discussion right now. I think multidisciplinary tumor board is important here. And for some of them, I think neoadjuvant therapy should be considered even off-label now based on the NEO-ADAURA data, and then resection and adjuvant osimertinib. And I think in the future, we're going to be incorporating neoadjuvant osimertinib into more patients going forward. So more to come on that. So just to briefly summarize, we talked about the exon 20 insertions and the sort of current and upcoming treatment options there, some of the novel agents to keep an eye on. We'll see what happens with ivonescimab. And then I think really, you know, osimertinib started 10 years ago just as a sort of T790M specific drug, and it's really been amazing to see the breadth of sort of applications and now really having an increasing role even for our patients with early stage disease with EGFR mutations.
Quick case to Jonathan from Jeff in the audience, who has a patient who had resected a lung tumor, EGFR exon 19, stage 1B, adjuvant chemo, then osimertinib. Circulating DNA was positive after chemo, but negative after starting OC. OC for 3 years or indefinitely with a positive ctDNA, and do you think that ctDNA is something that can be used to determine duration of OC?
Such a great question, and I think the data we have is, first of all, the approval is for 3 years of OC. However, I think in that case, I would have a very serious discussion with the patient about indefinite osimertinib. We know that patients at really high risk of recurring even on OC or after OC. So somewhat depends on how the patient tolerates it. I have seen some patients in the adjuvant setting, particularly older patients, that lose 15, 20 pounds, and you think this is hard to continue indefinitely. Sometimes a dose reduction makes it tolerable. But in the average case, I would say this patient needs to continue. I also consider, on the other side, stage 3 patient, if they become positive ctDNA after 3 years, I often talk about restarting.
So congratulations to Jeff for making Jonathan say that's a really great question.
Yeah.
That's our favorite thing, and thank you so much.
To Jeff.